He looked into my eyes. He made some tiny sound. It was so strained it was as if he couldn't speak any more. The organs of speech had closed up. But when he ran his tongue along his lip, and so low I scarcely heard him, he said, "The devil's instrument." "Yes," I said. "If you must believe that, then believe it, but play." His fingers hovered above the strings. He tapped the hollow wood with his fingertip, and now, trembling, he plucked at the strings to tune them and wound the pegs very slowly as if he were discovering the process with perfect concentration for the first time. Somewhere out on the boulevard, children laughed. Wooden wheels made their thick clatter over the cobblestones. The staccato notes were sour, dissonant, and they sharpened the tension. He pressed the instrument to his ear for a moment, and it seemed to me he didn't move again for an eternity, and then he slowly rose to his feet. I went back out of the pit and into the benches, and I stood staring at his black silhouette against the glow of the lighted stage. He turned to face the empty theatre as he had done so many times at the moment of the intermezzo, and he lifted the violin to his chin. And in a movement so swift it was like a flash of light in my eye, he brought the bow down across the strings. The first full-throated chords throbbed in the silence and were stretched as they deepened, scraping the bottom of sound itself. Then the notes rose, rich and dark and shrill, as if pumped out of the fragile violin by alchemy, until a raging torrent of melody suddenly flooded the hall. It seemed to roll through my body, to pass through my very bones. I couldn't see the movement of his fingers, the whipping of the bow. All I could see was the swaying of his body, his tortured posture as he let the music twist him, bend him forward, throw him back. It became higher, shriller, faster, yet the tone of each note was perfection. It was execution without effort, virtuosity beyond mortal dreams, and the violin was talking, not merely singing. The violin was insisting. The violin was telling a tale. The music was a lamentation, a future of terror looping itself into hypnotic dance rhythms, jerking Nicky even more wildly from side to side. His hair was a glistening mop against the footlights. The blood sweat had broken out on him. I could smell the blood. But I too was doubling over. I was backing away from him, slumping down on the bench as if to cower from it, as once before in this house terrified mortals had cowered before me. And I knew in some full and simultaneous fashion that the violin was telling everything that had happened to Nicky. It was the darkness exploded, the darkness molten, and the beauty of it was like the glow of smouldering coals. Just enough illumination to show how much darkness there really was. Gabrielle, too, was straining to keep her body still under the onslaught, her face constricted, her hands to her head. Her lion's mane of hair had shaken loose around her, her eyes were closed. But another sound was coming through the pure inundation of song. They were here. They had come into the theatre and were moving towards us through the wings. The music reached impossible peaks. The sound throttled for an instant and then released again. The mixture of feeling and pure logic drove it past the limits of the bearable, and yet it went on and on. And the others appeared slowly from behind the stage curtain. First, the stately figure of Eleni, then the boy, Laurent, and finally Felix and Eugenie. Acrobats, street players they had become. And they wore the clothes of such players, the men in white tights beneath dagged harlequin jerkins, the women in full bloomers and ruffled dresses and with dancing slippers on their feet. Rouge gleamed on their immaculate white faces, kohl outlined their dazzling vampire eyes. They glided towards Nicky as if drawn by a magnet, their beauty flowering ever more fully as they came into the glare of the stage candles, their hair shimmering, their movements agile and feline, their expressions rapt. Nicky turned slowly to face them as he writhed, and the song went into frenzied supplication, lurching and climbing and roaring along its melodic path. Eleni stared wide-eyed at him, as if horrified and enchanted. Then her arms rose straight up above her head in a slow, dramatic gesture. her body tensing, her neck becoming ever more graceful and long. The other woman had made a pivot and lifted her knee, toe-pointed down, in the first step of a dance. But it was the tall man who suddenly caught the pace of Nicky's music, as he jerked his head to the side and moved his legs and arms as if he were a great marionette controlled from the rafters above by four strings. The others saw it. They had seen the marionettes of the boulevard, and suddenly they all went into the mechanical attitude, their sudden movements like spasms, their faces like wooden faces, utterly blank. A great cool rush of delight passed through me, as if I could breathe suddenly in the blasted heat of the music, and I moaned with pleasure watching them flip and flop and throw up their legs, toes to the ceiling, and twirl on their invisible strings. But it was changing. He was playing to them now, even as they danced to him. He took a stride towards the stage and leapt up over the smoky trough of the footlights and landed in their midst. The light slithered off the instrument, off his glistening face. A new element of mockery infected the never-ending melody, a syncopation that staggered the song and made it all the more bitter and all the more sweet at the same time. The jerking, stiff-jointed puppets circled him, shuffling and bobbing along the floorboards. Fingers splayed, heads rocking from side to side, they jigged and twisted until all of them broke their rigid form as Nicky's melody melted into harrowing sadness, the dance becoming immediately liquid and heartbroken and slow. It was as if one mind controlled them, as if they danced to Nicky's thoughts as well as his music, and he began to dance with them as he played, the beat coming faster as he became the country fiddler at the Lenten bonfire, and they leapt in pairs like country lovers, the skirts of the women flaring, the men bowing their legs as they lifted the women, all creating postures of tenderest love. Frozen, I stared at the image, the preternatural dancers, the monster violinist, limbs moving with inhuman slowness, tantalizing grace. The music was like a fire consuming us all. Now it screamed of pain, of horror, of the pure rebellion of the soul against all things, and they again carried it into the visual, faces twisted in torment, like the mask of tragedy graven on the arch above them, and I knew that if I didn't turn my back on this, I would cry. I didn't want to hear any more. Or see any more. Nicky was swinging to and fro as if the violin were a beast he could no longer control, and he was stabbing at the strings with short, rough strokes of the bow. The dancers passed in front of him, in back of him, embraced him and caught him suddenly as he threw up his hands, the violin held high over his head. A loud, piercing laughter erupted from him. His chest shivered with it, his arms and legs quaking with it, and then he lowered his head and he fixed his eyes on me. And at the top of his voice he screamed, "I give you the theatre of the vampires! The theatre of the vampires! The greatest spectacle of the boulevard!" Astonished, the others stared at him. But again, all of one mind, they clapped their hands and roared. They leapt into the air, giving out shrieks of joy. They threw their arms about his neck and kissed him. And dancing around him in a circle, they turned him with their arms. The laughter rose, bubbling out of all of them, as he brought them close in his arms and answered their kisses, and with their long pink tongues they licked the blood sweat off his face. "The theatre of the vampires!" they broke from him and bawled it to the non-existent audience, to the world. They bowed to the footlights, and frolicking and screaming they leapt up to the rafters and then let themselves drop down with a storm of reverberation of the boards. The last shimmer of the music was gone, replaced by this cacophony of shrieking and stomping and laughter, like the clang of bells. I do not remember turning my back on them. I don't remember walking up the steps to the stage and going past them, but I must have, because I was suddenly sitting on the low, narrow table of my little dressing room, my back against the corner, my knee crooked, my head against the cold glass of the mirror, and Gabriel was there. I was breathing hoarsely, and the sound of it bothered me. I saw things, the wig I'd worn on the stage, the pasteboard shield, and these evoked thundering emotions. But I was suffocating. I could not think. Then Nicky appeared in the door, and he moved Gabrielle to the side with a strength that astonished her and astonished me, and he pointed his finger at me. "Well, don't you like it, my Lord Patron?" he asked, advancing, his words flowing in an unbroken stream so that they sounded like one great word. "Don't you admire its splendour, its perfection? Won't you endow the Theatre of the Vampires with the coin of the realm which you possess in such great abundance? How was it now? The new evil, the canker in the heart of the rose, death in the very midst of things." From a mute he had passed into mania, and even when he broke off talking, the low, senseless, frenzied sounds still issued from his lips like water from a spring. His face was drawn and hard, and glistening with the blood droplets clinging to it, and staining the white linen at his neck. And behind him there came an almost innocent laughter from the others, except for Eleni, who watched over his shoulder, trying very hard to comprehend what was really happening between us. He drew closer, half laughing, grinning, stabbing at my chest with his finger. "Well, speak! Don't you see the splendid mockery, the genius?" He struck his own chest with his fist. "They'll come to our performances, fill our coffers with gold, and never guess what they harbour, what flourishes right in the corner of the Parisian eye. In the back alleys we feed on them, and they clap for us before the lighted stage." Laughter from the boy behind him, the tink of a tambourine, the thin sound of the other woman singing, a long streak of the man's laughter, like a ribbon unfurling, charting his movement as he rushed around in a circle through the rattling scrims. Nicky drew in so that the light behind him vanished. I couldn't see Eleni. "Magnificent evil," he said. He was full of menace, and his white hands looked like the claws of a sea creature that could at any given moment move to tear me to bits. "To serve the god of the dark wood as he has not been served ever, and here in the very centre of civilization. And for this you saved the theatre. Out of your gallant patronage this sublime offering is born." "It is petty," I said. "It is merely beautiful and clever and nothing more." My voice had not been very loud, but it brought him to silence, and it brought the others to silence. And the shock in me melted slowly into another emotion, no less painful, merely easier to contain. Nothing but the sounds again from the boulevard. A glowering anger flowed out of him, his pupils dancing as he looked at me. "You're a liar, a contemptible liar," he said. "There is no splendour in it," I answered. "There is nothing sublime. Fooling helpless mortals, mocking them, and then going out from here at night to take life in the same old petty manner, one death after another in all its inevitable cruelty and shabbiness, so that we can live, and man can kill another man. Play your violin forever. Dance as you wish. Give them their money's worth if it keeps you busy and eats up eternity. It's simply clever and beautiful. A grove in the savage garden. Nothing more." "Vile liar," he said between his teeth. "You are God's fool, that's what you are. You who possessed the dark secret that soared above everything, rendered everything meaningless, and what did you do with it in those months when you ruled alone from Magnus's tower, but tried to live like a good man? A good man." He was close enough to kiss me, the blood of his spittle hitting my face. "Patron of the arts," he sneered. "Giver of gifts to your family, giver of gifts to us." He stepped back, looking down on me contemptuously. "Well, we will take the little theatre that you painted in gold and hung with velvet," he said, "and it will serve the forces of the devil more splendidly than he was ever served by the old coven." He turned and glanced at Eleni. He glanced back at the others. "We will make a mockery of all things sacred. We will lead them to ever greater vulgarity and profanity. We will astonish, we will beguile, but above all we will thrive on their gold as well as their blood, and in their midst we will grow strong." "Yes," said the boy behind him, "we will become invincible." His face had a crazed look, the look of the zealot as he gazed at Nicholas.
We will have names and places in their very world.
And power over them, said the other woman, and a vantage point from which to study them and know them and perfect our methods of destroying them when we choose. I want the theatre, Nicholas said to me. I want it from you. The deed, the money to reopen it. My assistants here are ready to listen to me. You may have it, if you wish, I answered. It is yours if it will take you and your malice and your fractured reason off my hands. I got up off the dressing table and went towards him, and I think that he meant to block my path, but something unaccountable happened. When I saw he wouldn't move, my anger rose up and out of me like an invisible fist, and I saw him moved backwards as if the fist had struck him, and he hit the wall with sudden force. I could have been free of the place in an instant. I knew Gabriel was only waiting to follow me. But I didn't leave. I stopped and looked back at him, and he was still against the wall as if he couldn't move, and he was watching me, and the hatred was as pure, as undiluted by remembered love as it had been all along. But I wanted to understand. I wanted really to know what had happened. And I came towards him again in silence, and this time it was I who was menacing, and my hands looked like claws, and I could feel his fear. They were all, except for Eleni, full of fear. I stopped when I was very close to him, and he looked directly at me, and it was as if he knew exactly what I was asking him. "All a misunderstanding, my love," he said, acid on the tongue. The blood sweat had broken out again, and his eyes glistened as if they were wet. It was to hurt others, don't you see, the violin playing, to anger them, to secure for me an island where they could not rule. They would watch my ruin, unable to do anything about it. I didn't answer. I wanted him to go on. And when we decided to go to Paris, I thought we would starve in Paris, that we would go down and down and down. It was what I wanted rather than what they wanted, that I, the favored son, should rise for them. I thought we would go down. We were supposed to go down. Oh, Nicky, I whispered. But you didn't go down, Lestat, he said, his eyebrows rising. The hunger, the cold, none of it stopped you. You were a triumph. The rage thickened his voice again. You didn't drink yourself to death in the gutter. You turned everything upside down. And for every aspect of our proposed damnation you found exuberance, and there was no end to your enthusiasm and the passion coming out of you, and the light, always the light. And in exact proportion to the light coming out of you there was darkness in me, every exuberance piercing me and creating its exact proportion of darkness and despair. And then the magic, when you got the magic, irony of ironies, you protected me from it. And what did you do with it but use your satanic powers to simulate the actions of a good man? I turned around. I saw them scattered in the shadows, and farthest away the figure of Gabrielle. I saw the light on her hand as she raised it, beckoning for me to come away. Nicky reached up and touched my shoulders. I could feel the hatred coming through his touch, loathsome to be touched in hate. Like a mindless beam of sunlight, you routed the bats of the old coven, he whispered. And for what purpose? What does it mean, the murdering monster who is filled with light? I turned and smacked him, and sent him hurtling into the dressing room, his right hand smashing the mirror, his head cracking against the far wall. For one moment he lay like something broken against the mass of old clothing, and then his eyes gathered their determination again, and his face softened into a slow smile. He righted himself, and slowly, as an indignant mortal might, he smoothed his coat and his rumpled hair. It was like my gestures under Les Innocents when my captors had sent me down in the dirt. And he came forward with the same dignity, and the smile was as ugly as any I had ever seen. "I despise you," he said, "but I am done with you. I have the power from you, and I know how to use it, which you do not. I am in a realm at last, where I choose to triumph. In darkness, we're equal now. And you will give me the theatre, that because you owe it to me, and you are a giver of things, aren't you? A giver of gold coins to hungry children. And then I won't ever look upon your light again. He stepped around me and stretched out his arms to the others. Come, my beauties, come. We have plays to write, business to attend to. You have things to learn from me. I know what mortals really are. We must get down to the serious invention of our dark and splendid art. We will make a coven to rival all covens. We will do what has never been done. The others looked at me, frightened, hesitant. And in this still and tense moment I heard myself take a deep breath. My vision broadened. I saw the wings around us again, the high rafters, the walls of scenery transecting the darkness, and beyond, the little blaze along the foot of the dusty stage. I saw the house veiled in shadow, and knew in one limitless recollection all that had happened here. And I saw a nightmare hatch another nightmare, and I saw a story come to an end. The theatre of the vampires, I whispered. We have worked the dark trick on this little place. No one of the others dared to answer. Nicholas only smiled. And as I turned to leave the theatre, I raised my hand in a gesture that urged them all towards him. I said my farewell. We were not far from the lights of the boulevard when I stopped in my tracks. Without words, a thousand horrors came to me, that Armand would come to destroy him, that his newfound brothers and sisters would tire of his frenzy and desert him, that morning would find him stumbling through the streets, unable to find a hiding place from the sun. I looked up at the sky. I couldn't speak or breathe. Gabrielle put her arms around me, and I held her, burying my face in her hair. Like cool velvet was her skin, her face, her lips, and her love surrounded me with a monstrous purity that had nothing to do with human hearts and human flesh. I lifted her off her feet, embracing her, and in the dark we were like lovers carved out of the same stone who had no memory of a separate life at all. "He's made his choice, my son," she said. "What's done is done, and you're free of him now." "Mother, how can you say it?" I whispered. "He didn't know. He doesn't know still." "Let him go, Lestat," she said. "They will care for him." "But now I have to find that devil Armand, don't I?" I said wearily. "I have to make him leave them alone." The following evening, when I came into Paris, I learned that Nicky had already been to Roger. He had come an hour earlier, pounding the doors like a madman, and shouting from the shadows he had demanded the deed to the theatre, and money that he said I promised to him. He had threatened Roger and his family. He had also told Roger to write to Renaud and his troupe in London and to tell them to come home, that they had a new theatre awaiting them. And he expected them back at once. When Roger refused, he demanded the address of the players in London and began to ransack Roger's desk. I went into a silent fury when I heard this. So he would make them all vampires, would he? This demon fledgling, this reckless and frenzied monster. This would not come to pass. I told Roger to send a courier to London with word that Nicholas de Lanfond had lost his reason. The players must not come home. And then I went to the Boulevard du Temple, and I found him at his rehearsals, excited and mad as he had been before. He wore his fancy clothes again, and his old jewels from the time when he had been his father's favourite son, but his tie was askew, his stockings crooked, and his hair was as wild and unkempt as the hair of a prisoner in the Bastille, who hadn't seen himself in a mirror in 20 years. Before Eleni and the others, I told him he would get nothing from me, unless I had the promise that no actor or actress of Paris would ever be slain or seduced by the new coven, that Renaud and his troupe would never be brought into the theatre of the vampires now or in the years to come, that Roger, who would hold the purse strings of the theatre, must never come to the slightest harm. He laughed at me. He ridiculed me as he had before. But Eleni silenced him. She was horrified to learn of his impulsive designs. It was she who gave the promises and exacted them from the others. It was she who intimidated him and confused him with jumbled language of the old ways and made him back down. And it was to Eleni, finally, that I gave control of the theatre of the vampires and the income to pass through Roger, which would allow her to do with it what she pleased. Before I left her that night, I asked her what she knew of Armand. Gabrielle was with us. We were in the alleyway again, near the stage door. "He watches," Eleni answered. "Sometimes he lets himself be seen." Her face was very confusing to me, sorrowful. "But God only knows what he will do," she added fearfully, "when he discovers what is really going on here." Part 5. The Vampire Armand. 1. Spring rain. Rain of light that saturated every new leaf of the trees in the street, every square of paving, drift of rain threading light through the empty darkness itself. And the ball in the Palais Royal. The king and queen were there, dancing with the people. Talk in the shadows of intrigue. Who cares? Kingdoms rise and fall. Just don't burn the paintings in the Louvre, that's all. Lost in a sea of mortals again. Fresh complexions and ruddy cheeks, mounds of powdered hair atop feminine heads with all manner of millinery nonsense in them, even minute ships with three masts, tiny trees, little birds, landscapes of pearl and ribbon, broad-chested men like cocks in satin coats like feathered wings. The diamonds hurt my eyes. The voices touched the surface of my skin at times. The laughter, the echo of unholy laughter. Wreaths of candles, blinding. The froth of music positively lapping the walls. Gusts of rain from the open doors. Scent of humans gently stoking my hunger. White shoulders, white necks. Powerful hearts running at that eternal rhythm, so many gradations among these naked children hidden in riches, savages laboring beneath a swaddling of chenille, encrustations of embroidery, feet aching over high heels, masks like scabs about their eyes. The air comes out of one body and is breathed into another. The music, does it pass out of one ear and into another, as the old expression goes? We breathe the light, we breathe the music, we breathe the moment as it passes through us. Now and then eyes settled on me with some vague air of expectation. My white skin made them pause. But what was that when they let blood out of their veins themselves to keep their delicate pallor? Let me hold the basin for you and drink it afterwards. And my eyes, what were those in this sea of paste jewels? Yet their whispers slithered around me, and those scents, ah, not a one was like another. And as clearly as if spoken aloud it came, the summons from mortals here and there, sensing what I was, and the lust. In some ancient language they welcomed death, they ached for death as death was passing through the room. But did they really know? Of course they didn't know. And I did not know. That was the perfect horror. And who am I to bear this secret, to hunger so to impart it, to want to take that slender woman there and suck the blood right out of the plump flesh of her round little breast? The music rushed on. Human music. The colours of the room flamed for an instant as if the whole would melt. The hunger sharpened. It was no longer an idea. My veins were throbbing with it. Someone would die, sucked dry in less than a moment. I cannot stand it, thinking of it, knowing it's about to happen. Fingers on the throat, feeling the blood in the vein, feeling the flesh. Give it to me. Where?
This is my body, this is my blood.
Send out your power, Lestat, like a reptile tongue to gather in a flick the appropriate heart. Plump little arms ripe for the squeezing, men's faces on which the close-shaven blonde beard all but glitters, muscles struggling in my fingers, you haven't got a chance. And beneath this divine chemistry suddenly, this panorama of the denial of decay, I saw the bones. Skulls under these preposterous wigs, two gaping holes peering from behind the uplifted fan. A room of wobbling skeletons, waiting only for the tolling of the bell, just as I had seen the audience that night in the pit of Renault's when I had done the tricks that terrified them. The horror should be visited upon every other being in this room. I had to get out. I'd made a terrible miscalculation. This was death, and I could get away from it if I could just get out. But I was tangled in mortal beings as if this monstrous place were a snare for a vampire. If I bolted, I'd send the entire ballroom into panic. As gently as I could, I pushed to the open doors. And against the far wall, a backdrop of satin and filigree, I saw, out of the corner of my eye, like something imagined, Armand. Armand. If there had been a summons, I never heard it. If there was a greeting, I didn't sense it now. He was merely looking at me, a radiant creature in jewels and scalloped lace. And it was Cinderella revealed at the ball, this vision. Sleeping Beauty opening her eyes under a mesh of cobwebs and wiping them all away with one sweep of her warm hand. The sheer pitch of incarnate beauty made me gasp. Yes, perfect mortal raiment. And yet he seemed all the more supernatural, his face too dazzling, his dark eyes fathomless, and just for a split second glinting as if they were windows to the fires of hell. And when his voice came, it was low and almost teasing, forcing me to concentrate to hear it. "All night you've been searching for me," he said, "and here I am, waiting for you. I have been waiting for you all along." I think I sensed, even then, as I stood unable to look away, that never in my years of wandering this earth would I ever have such a rich revelation of the true horror that we are. Heartbreakingly innocent he seemed in the midst of the crowd. Yet I saw crypts when I looked at him, and I heard the beat of the kettle drums. I saw torchlit fields where I had never been, heard vague incantations, felt the heat of raging fires on my face, and they didn't come out of him, these visions. Rather, I drew them out on my own. Yet never had Nicholas, mortal or immortal, been so alluring. Never had Gabrielle held me so in thrall. Dear God, this is love. This is desire. And all my past amours have been but the shadow of this. And it seemed in a murmuring pulse of thought he gave me to know that I had been very foolish to think it would not be so. Who can love us, you and I, as we can love each other? He whispered. And it seemed his lips actually moved. Others looked at him. I saw them drifting with a ludicrous slowness. I saw their eyes pass over him. I saw the light fall on him at a rich new angle as he lowered his head. I was moving towards him. It seemed he raised his right hand and beckoned, and then he didn't, and he had turned, and I saw the figure of a young boy ahead of me with narrow waist and straight shoulders, and high, firm calves under silk stockings, a boy who turned as he opened a door and beckoned again. A mad thought came to me. I was moving after him, and it seemed that none of the other things had happened. There was no crypt under Les Innocents, and he had not been that ancient, fearful fiend. We were somehow safe. We were the sum of our desires, and this was saving us. And the vast, untasted horror of my own immortality did not lie before me, and we were navigating calm seas with familiar beacons, and it was time to be in each other's arms. A dark room surrounded us, private, cold. The noise of the ball was far away. He was heated with the blood he'd drunk, and I could hear the strong force of his heart. He drew me closer to him, and beyond the high windows there flashed the passing lights of the carriages, with dim, incessant sound that spoke of safety and comfort, and all the things that Paris was. I had never died. The world was beginning again. I put out my arms and felt his heart against me, and calling out to my Nicholas, I tried to warn him, to tell him we were all of us doomed. Our life was slipping inch by inch from us, and seeing the apple trees in the orchard, drenched in green sunlight, I felt I would go mad.
"No, no, my dearest one," he was whispering, "nothing but peace and sweetness, and your arms in mine."
"You know it was the damnedest luck," I whispered suddenly. "I am an unwilling devil. I cry like some vagrant child. I want to go home."
"Yes,
yes," his lips tasted like blood, but it was not human blood. It was that elixir that Magnus had given me, and I felt myself recoil. I could get away this time. I had another chance. The wheel had turned full round. I was crying out that I wouldn't drink. I wouldn't, and then I felt the two hot shafts driven hard through my neck and down to my soul. I couldn't move. It was coming as it had come that night, the rapture. A thousandfold what it was when I held mortals in my arms, and I knew what he was doing. He was feeding upon me. He was draining me. And going down on my knees, I felt myself held by him, the blood pouring out of me with a monstrous volition I couldn't stop. "Devil!" I tried to scream. I forced the word up and up until it broke from my lips and the paralysis broke from my limbs. "Devil!" I roared again, and I caught him in his swoon and hurled him backwards to the floor. In an instant, I had my hands upon him and, shattering the French doors, had dragged him out with me into the night. His heels were scraping on the stones. His face had become pure fury. I clutched his right arm and swung him from side to side so that his head snapped back, and he could not see nor gauge where he was nor catch hold of anything, and with my right hand I beat him and beat him until the blood was running out of his ears and his eyes and his nose. I dragged him through the trees away from the lights of the Palais, and as he struggled, as he sought to resurrect himself with a burst of force, he shot his declaration at me that he would kill me because he had my strength now. He'd drunk it out of me, and coupled with his own strength it would make him impossible to defeat. Maddened, I clutched at his neck. Pushing his head down against the path beneath me, I pinned him down, strangling him until the blood in great gushes poured out of his open mouth. He would have screamed if he could. My knees drove into his chest. His neck bulged under my fingers, and the blood spurted and bubbled out of him. And he turned his head from side to side, his eyes growing bigger and bigger, but seeing nothing. And then when I felt him weak and limp, I let him go. I beat him again, turning him this way and that, and then I drew my sword to sever his head. Let him live like that if he can. Let him be immortal like that if he can. I raised the sword, and when I looked down at him, the rain was pelting his face, and he was staring up at me, as one half alive, unable to plead for mercy, unable to move. I waited. I wanted him to beg. I wanted him to give me that powerful voice full of lies and cunning, the voice that had made me believe for one pure and dazzling instant that I was alive and free and in the state of grace again. Damnable, unforgivable lie! Lie I'd never forget for as long as I walked the earth. I wanted the rage to carry me over the threshold to his grave. But nothing came from him. And in this moment of stillness and misery for him, his beauty slowly returned. He lay a broken child on the gravel path, only yards from the passing traffic, the ring of horses' hooves, the rumble of the wooden wheels. And in this broken child were centuries of evil, and centuries of knowledge. And out of him there came no ignominious entreaty, but merely the soft and bruised sense of what he was. Old, old evil,
eyes that had seen dark ages of which I only dream.
I let him go, and I stood up and sheathed my sword. I walked a few paces from him, and collapsed upon a wet stone bench. Far away, busy figures labored about the shattered window of the palace. But the night lay between us and those confused mortals, and I looked at him listlessly as he lay still. His face was turned to me, but not by design, his hair a tangle of curls and blood. And with his eyes closed, and his hand open beside him, he appeared the abandoned offspring of time and supernatural accident, someone as miserable as myself. What had he done to become what he was? Could one so young, so long ago, have guessed the meaning of any decision, let alone the vow to become this? I rose, and walking slowly to him, I stood over him and looked at him, at the blood that soaked his lace shirt and stained his face. It seemed he sighed, that I heard the passage of his breath. He didn't open his eyes, and to mortals perhaps there would have been no expression there. But I felt his sorrow. I felt its immensity, and I wished I didn't feel it, and for one moment I understood the gulf that divided us, and the gulf that divided his attempt to overpower me from my rather simple defense of myself. Desperately he had tried to vanquish what he did not comprehend, and impulsively and almost effortlessly I had beaten him back. All my pain with Nicholas came back to me, and Gabriel's words, and Nicholas's denunciations. My anger was nothing to his misery, his despair. And this, perhaps, was the reason that I reached down and gathered him up. And maybe I did it because he was so exquisitely beautiful and so lost. And we were, after all, of the same ilk. Natural enough, wasn't it, that one of his own should take him away from this place where mortals would sooner or later have approached him, driven him stumbling away. He gave no resistance to me. In a moment he was standing on his own feet, and then he walked drowsily beside me, my arm about his shoulder, bolstering him and steadying him until we were moving away from the Palais Royal, towards the Rue Saint-Honoré. I only half-glanced at the figures passing us, until I saw a familiar shape under the trees, with no scent of mortality coming from it, and I realized that Gabrielle had been there for some time. She came forward, hesitantly and silently, her face stricken when she saw the blood-drenched lace and the lacerations on his white skin, and she reached out as if to help me with the burden of him, though she did not seem to know how. Somewhere, far off in the darkened gardens, the others were near. I heard them before I saw them. Nicky was there too. They had come as Gabrielle had come, drawn over the miles, it seemed, by the tumult, or what vague messages I could not imagine, and they merely waited and watched as we moved away. 2. We took him with us to the livery stables, and there I put him on my mare. But he looked as if he would let himself fall off at any moment, and so I mounted behind him and the three of us rode out. All the way through the country I wondered what I would do. I wondered what it meant to bring him to my lair. Gabrielle didn't give any protest. Now and then she glanced over at him. I heard nothing from him, and he was small and self-contained as he sat in front of me, light as a child but not a child. Surely he had always known where the tower was, but had its bars kept him out? Now I meant to take him inside it. And why didn't Gabrielle say something to me? It was the meeting we had wanted. It was the thing for which we had waited, but surely she knew what he had just done. When we finally dismounted, he walked ahead of me, and he waited for me to reach the gate. I had taken out the iron key to the lock, and I studied him, wondering what promises one exacts from such a monster before opening one's door. Did the ancient laws of hospitality mean anything to the creatures of the night? His eyes were large and brown and defeated. Almost drowsy, they seemed. He regarded me for a long, silent moment, and then he reached out with his left hand, and his fingers curled around the iron crossbar in the center of the gate. I stared helplessly as with a loud, grinding noise the gate started to rip loose from the stone. But he stopped and contented himself with merely bending the iron bar a little. The point had been made. He could have entered this tower any time that he wished. I examined the iron bar that he'd twisted. I had beaten him. Could I do what he had just done? I didn't know. And unable to calculate my own powers, how could I ever calculate his? "Come," Gabrielle said a little impatiently, and she led the way down the stairs to the dungeon crypt. It was cold here, as always, the fresh spring air never touching the place. She made a big fire in the old hearth while I lighted the candles, and as he sat on the stone bench watching us, I saw the effect of the warmth on him, the way that his body seemed to grow slightly larger, the way that he breathed it in. As he looked about, it was as if he were absorbing the light. His gaze was clear. Impossible to overestimate the effect of warmth and light on vampires. Yet the old cavern had forsworn both. I settled on another bench, and I let my eyes roam about the broad, low chamber as his eyes roamed. Gabrielle had been standing all this while, and now she approached him. She had taken out a handkerchief, and she touched this to his face. He stared at her in the same way that he stared at the fire and the candles, and the shadows leaping on the curved ceiling. This seemed to interest him as simply as anything else. And I felt a shudder when I realized the bruises on his face were now almost gone. The bones were whole again, the shape of the face having been fully restored, and he was only a little gaunt from the blood he had lost. My heart expanded slightly against my will, as it had on the battlements when I had heard his voice. I thought of the pain only half an hour ago in the palais, when the lie had broken with a stab of his fangs into my neck. I hated him, but I couldn't stop looking at him. Gabrielle combed his hair for him. She took his hands and wiped the blood from them, and he seemed helpless as all this was done. And she had not so much the expression of a ministering angel as an expression of curiosity, a desire to be near him and to touch him and examine him. In the quavering illumination they looked at one another. He hunched forward a little, eyes darkening and full of expression now as they turned again to the grate. Had it not been for the blood on his lace ruff, he might have looked human. Might. "What will you do now?" I asked. I spoke to make it clear to Gabrielle. "Will you remain in Paris and let Eleni and the others go on?" No answer from him. He was studying me, studying the stone benches, the sarcophagi, three sarcophagi. "Surely you know what they're doing," I said. "Will you leave Paris or remain?" It seemed he wanted to tell me again the magnitude of what I had done to him and the others, but this faded away. For one moment his face was wretched. It was defeated and warm and full of human misery. How old was he, I wondered. How long ago had he been a human who looked like that? He heard me, but he didn't give an answer. He looked to Gabrielle, who stood near the fire, and then to me, and silently he said, "Love me. You have destroyed everything. But if you love me, it can all be restored in a new form. Love me." This silent entreaty had an eloquence, however, that I can't put into words. "What can I do to make you love me?" he whispered. "What can I give? The knowledge of all I have witnessed? The secrets of our powers? The mystery of what I am?" It seemed blasphemous to answer. And as I had on the battlements, I found myself on the edge of tears. For all the purity of his silent communications, his voice gave a lovely resonance to his sentiments when he actually spoke. It occurred to me, as it had in Notre Dame, that he spoke the way angels must speak if they exist. But I was awakened from this irrelevant thought, this obviating thought, by the fact that he was now beside me. He was closing his arm around me, and pressing his forehead against my face. He gave that summons again, not the rich, thudding seduction of that moment in the Palais Royal, but the voice that had sung to me over the miles,
and he told me there were things the two of us would know and understand as mortals never could. He told me that if I opened to him and gave him my strength and my secrets, that he would give me his. He had been driven to try to destroy me, and he loved me all the more that he could not. That was a tantalizing thought. Yet I felt danger. The word that came unbidden to me was, beware. I don't know what Gabrielle saw or heard. I don't know what she felt. Instinctively I avoided his eyes. There seemed nothing in the world I wanted more at this moment than to look right at him and understand him, and yet I knew I must not. I saw the bones under Les Innocents again, the flickering hellfires I had imagined in the Palais Royal, and all the lace and velvet in the 18th century could not give him a human face. I couldn't keep this from him, and it pained me that it was impossible for me to explain it to Gabrielle, and the awful silence between me and Gabrielle was at that moment almost too much to bear. With him I could speak. Yes, with him I could dream dreams. Some reverence and terror in me made me reach out and embrace him, and I held him, battling my confusion and my desire. "Leave Paris, yes," he whispered. "But take me with you. I don't know how to exist here now. I stumble through a carnival of horrors. Please," I heard myself say, "no." "Have I no value to you?" he asked. He turned to Gabrielle. Her face was anguished and still as she looked at him. I couldn't know what went on in her heart, and to my sadness I realized that he was speaking to her and locking me out. What was her answer? But he was imploring both of us now. "Is there nothing outside yourself you would respect?"
"I might have destroyed you tonight," I said. "It was respect which kept me from that."
"No," he shook his head in a startlingly human fashion. "That you never could have done."
I smiled. It was probably true, but we were destroying him quite completely in another way.
"Yes," he said, "that's true. You are destroying me." "Help me," he whispered. "Give me but a few short years of all you have before you, the two of you. I beg you, that is all I ask."
"No," I said again. He was only a foot from me on the bench. He was looking at me. And there came the horrible spectacle again of his face, narrowing and darkening and caving in upon itself in rage. It was as if he had no real substance. Only will kept him robust and beautiful. And when the flow of his will was interrupted, he melted like a wax doll. But, as before, he recovered himself almost instantly. The hallucination was past. He stood up and backed away from me until he was in front of the fire. The will coming from him was palpable. His eyes were like something that didn't belong to him, nor to anything on earth, and the fire blazing behind him made an eerie nimbus around his head.
"I curse you," he whispered.
I felt a jet of fear.
"I curse you," he said again and came closer. "Love, mortals, then, and live as you have lived, recklessly, with appetite for everything and love for everything, but there will come a time when only the love of your own kind can save you."
He glanced at Gabrielle.
"And I don't mean children such as this."
This was so strong that I couldn't conceal its effect on me, and I realized I was rising from the bench and slipping away from him towards Gabrielle.
"I don't come empty-handed to you," he pressed, his voice deliberately softening. "I don't come begging with nothing to give of my own. Look at me. Tell me you don't need what you see in me, one who has the strength to take you through the ordeals that lie ahead."
His eyes flashed on Gabrielle, and for one moment he remained locked to her, and I saw her harden and begin to tremble. "Let her be," I said.
"You don't know what I say to her," he said coldly. "I do not try to hurt her. But in your love of mortals, what have you already done?"
He would say something terrible if I didn't stop him, something to wound me or Gabrielle. He knew all that had happened with Nicky. I knew that he did. If, Somewhere deep down in my soul, I wished for the end of Nicky. He would know that, too. Why had I let him in? Why had I not known what he could do? "Oh, but it's always a travesty, don't you see?" he said with that same gentleness. "Each time the death and the awakening will ravage the mortal spirit, so that one will hate you for taking his life, another will run to excesses that you scorn, a third will emerge mad and raving, another a monster you cannot control. One will be jealous of your superiority, another shut you out," and here he shot his glance to Gabrielle again and half-smiled, "and the veil will always come down between you. Make a legion. You will be, always and forever, alone." "I don't want to hear this. It means nothing," I said. Gabrielle's face had undergone some ugly change. She was staring at him with hatred now, I was sure of it. He made that bitter little noise that is a laugh, but isn't a laugh at all. "Lovers with a human face," he mocked me. "Don't you see your error? The other one hates you beyond all reason, and she... Why, the dark blood has made her even colder, has it not? But even for her, strong as she is, there will come moments when she fears to be immortal, and who will she blame for what was done to her?" "You are a fool," Gabrielle whispered. "You tried to protect the violinist from it, but you never sought to protect her." "Don't say any more," I answered. "You make me hate you. Is that what you want?" "But I speak the truth, and you know it. And what you will never know, either of you, is the full depth of each other's hatreds and resentments, or suffering, or love." He paused, and I could say nothing. He was doing exactly what I feared he would, and I didn't know how to defend myself. "If you leave me now with this one," he continued, "you will do it again. Nicholas you never possessed. And she already wonders how she will ever get free of you. And unlike her, you cannot stand to be alone." I couldn't answer. Gabrielle's eyes became smaller, her mouth a little more cruel. "So the time will come when you will seek other mortals," he went on, "hoping once more that the dark trick will bring you the love you crave. And of these newly mutilated and unpredictable children, you'll try to fashion your citadels against time. Well, they will be prisons if they last for half a century. I warn you, it is only with those as powerful and wise as yourself that the true citadel against time can be built." The citadel against time. Even in my ignorance the words had their power, and the fear in me expanded, reached out to compass a thousand other causes. He seemed distant for a moment, indescribably beautiful in the firelight, the dark auburn strands of his hair barely touching his smooth forehead, his lips parted in a beatific smile. "If we cannot have the old ways, can't we have each other?" he asked. And now his voice was the voice of the summons again. "Who else can understand your suffering? Who else knows what passed through your mind the night you stood on the stage of your little theater and you frightened all those you had loved?" "Don't speak about that," I whispered. But I was softening all over, drifting into his eyes and his voice. Very near to me was the ecstasy I'd felt that night on the battlements. With all my will, I reached out for Gabrielle. "Who understands what passed through your mind when my renegade followers, reveling in the music of your precious fiddler, devised their ghastly boulevard enterprise?" he asked. I didn't speak. "The theater of the vampires," his lips lengthened in the saddest smile. "Does she comprehend the irony of it? The cruelty? Does she know what it was like when you stood on that stage as a young man and you heard the audience screaming for you? When time was your friend, not your enemy as it is now? When in the wings you put out your arms and your mortal darlings came to you, your little family, folding themselves against you?"
"Stop. Please, I ask you to stop.
Does anyone else know the size of your soul?"
"Witchcraft.
Had it ever been used with more skill? And what was he really saying to us beneath this liquid flow of beautiful language? Come to me, and I shall be the sun round which you are locked in orbit, and my rays shall lay bare the secrets you keep from each other. And I, who possess charms and powers of which you have no inkling, shall control and possess and destroy you. I asked you before,